There have been many walls throughout the sordid course of human history. Big walls, small walls, walls with nutty anatomical appendages unfit for the tongues of children, walls composed of abandoned desserts, especially red velvet cake, so trendy among the hipsters, walls erected in pressing financial crises, walls in China, in Berlin, in other unnamed cities that are not recognized by maps. There is likely a wall near you right now, gracious listener. Walls called great, walls underappreciated, but greater than those which carry the lofty modifiers. Walls ignored by the eyes of careless human observers. Is it any wonder, then, that few walls have refused to speak to the shuffling and unsettling troglodytes who fail to appreciate these mighty, humorous edifices?
Okay, so I am here with Laurel Snyder, who is most recently the author of Any Which Wall. Laurel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. More coffee, please. More coffee for you, too. I wanted to, first of all, ask about the conditions, the extraordinary conditions in which Any Which Wall was written in. Oh boy, you got a tongue twister there. Your husband had lost his job, you were 6 months pregnant, and you told your agent that you needed a certain amount of money by a certain date.
Yes.
Which seems to me equivalent to some sort of mob scenario, but nevertheless, I'm wondering if you attribute your success in landing this particular gig to the flexibility of the YA market. Was it luck, or did you just have a particularly stellar agent who knew where the bodies were dug?
I actually have a really, really, really remarkable and unusual situation, which is that I have kept, essentially, I'm a small enough fish that they can give me, I think, a certain amount of flexibility. You know, if you've sold a book for a massive amount of money and they have to earn it all back, and like sort of there's all these other pieces in play, but I actually think that sort of there's a certain freedom to being at the other end of the spectrum. That if so, basically the amount of money I was asking for was small enough that it wasn't unreasonable that, you know, since nothing disastrous was happening with the book that was already coming out, that sort of she could go and say like, well, if we ask for a small enough amount of money, we can get that. And it I don't know, it's backwards of sort of what people's goals are in the publishing market, I think, but that if you ask for reasonable things, reasonable people will often say yes to them.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. The other piece is I just have a really, really, really special editor, and she was in a position not to have to sort of fight a committee, and I guess, I mean, this is all my speculation, but my understanding is essentially that they just wanted to do the next book.
Yeah.
And so there was sort of some negotiation back and forth about what exactly it would be, and I wrote some pages and stuff like that. But they've been Random House has been incredibly generous to me in giving me freedom to kind of do whatever I want to do next.
Well, to touch upon this answer as to what reasonable is, now some writers who are looking to, you know, pay a mortgage on a home, a significant mortgage, or in a affluent area, like, say, New York, they would say, well, people like Laurel Snyder are undercutting us. We need to be raking in the lucre here.
I mean, I suppose
writers get screwed enough as it is. Who is this upstart going ahead and writing some book on the fly in a matter of a few months?
I started as a poet, and when you're a waitress, and I mean, sort of, I always assumed that my identity as a writer would be tied to poetry and waitressing, basically. And when you don't have the expectation of making any money, you write what you want to write, because you want to write it. It was actually a huge sort of mental shift for me to think about writing having anything to do with a market or anything to do with money. And I think, I mean, I think that in some ways is why sort of this situation with Any Which Wall happened, was that like, I didn't know what the rules were. So it didn't seem unreasonable that I would call my agent and say like, I need some money. I've never heard of anybody else in sort of exactly that situation, but I think it comes from not thinking about money.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I live in a really small house in a crappy neighborhood in Atlanta, and you could, too, if you wanted to.
Well, I may very well if this economy continues.
We've got a spare bedroom.
Well, that's very interesting. I also, this begs to mind another question I had, but I kind of want to get back into this. This was an unusual writing situation in the sense that you had to turn out the book relatively quick.
Yes.
As opposed to writing for the pleasure and worrying about the money later.
But this is the difference in the children's market in general. Yeah, no, the children's market, people sort of, books tend to come quicker. I mean, I know a lot of people who do a novel a year within that middle grade or that YA market, which I think is really unusual, would be really unusual for most literary fiction writers to crank out a novel a year. I don't know. Like, there's a part of me that feels like there's sort of different. And I will say that, like, the next book I'm not contracting for because I want the freedom to take 2 or 3 years if I need to take 2 or 3 years to write it. So there's like a plus and a minus on each side, but like that, it's a little problematic for me because I do feel like it creates this idea that like, well, children's writing is easier. That like, if you can crank out a book a year, it's like writing, I don't know, people might say like a Harlequin romance novel, or it's like writing, you know, whatever. And it's certainly different for picture books, but I don't know if it's that different. I mean, if you really sit down, if somebody said to you, I'll give you enough money every year to live on, basic minimal costs, not ridiculous money, but like basic minimal cost, and you're going to sit down and write 8 hours a day.
Yeah.
You don't think you could write a novel in a year?
Absolutely. I totally could. Right. I think any of us could.
I think, right, that's the point, is I think that we've detached the idea of labor
from
the idea of being a writer.
Yeah.
And for me, being a poet, it had no relationship to labor. My labor was my waitressing, and being a poet was being a poet. Yeah. And they had nothing, I mean, they had a lot to do with one another, but they had nothing really to do with one another professionally. In some ways, for me, this was like a whole different model. I think for a lot of novelists, they it gets wrapped into being a teacher. They do tutorials, or they read, like, they have all these other lives that are sort of part of being a writer that then get in the way of the writing itself. And so it's just about making choices, I think.
But on the other hand, the Hollywood studio system was set up precisely in the way you described, where they set writers in a room for 8 hours a day,
right.
And it wasn't always successful. I mean, writing has to be fluid
for sure.
In some sense.
I'm not saying we should force anybody to write anything. I'm just saying that I think a lot of the people I know who've been trying to finish a novel for a long time might finish it if they had a small enough amount of money to live on.
Yeah.
But then the problem is that also takes away the dream of the... I don't have a dream of a six-figure advance.
Yeah.
Like, I don't actually think that that's going to happen for me. I think the children's market also... Books tend to stay in print longer.
Yeah.
And you tend to do more of them more often. So you end up in a situation where, like, I have 4 books coming out next year. If I end up with 10 books in print, and I'm gathering a small royalty on each of them, and then I do a sort of an advance for a meager amount once a year, like, I'll be at a point someday where I'll have an income.
Yeah.
I mean, but not the dream of the big bump.
You're saying...
And that, so I basically, in my head, I don't think about the idea of, like, the windfall. I think about, as I did when I was a waitress, making a meager sort of salary every year and living on that money. And it's just a different way of looking at it.
You're saying then that writers, particularly of the YA persuasion, should probably devote their labors towards creating a backlist of titles to keep revenue coming.
I think that's
in.
A big
that's
part
a
of it. Well, I don't know if that. The I don't know if the writer should think about it that way, but I think that is how the market works.
Yeah.
More for children's writing is, on some level, it is quantity. And I think that that would be really problematic for most of the adult novelists I know to think about their writing in terms of quantity and to think about their writing. This is not to say that there aren't, obviously, children's authors who spend, you know, Norton Juster just sold, like...
Phantom Tollbooth, so you can follow.
Right,
Jules Pfeiffer,
The Jules Pfeiffer Phantom Tollbooth follow-up every 50 years and made a joke about, like, doing another one in 50 years. Obviously, there are children's writers who don't crank out a book a year, and obviously there are adult authors. I mean, Juliana Baggett is a good example of somebody who, like, has written more books than anybody I know, and she writes adult novels, and she writes books of poems, and so, like, it can be anything. But I think more of the people I know who write adult novels have the idea that they're going to get a big enough advance, or they're going to hit the bestseller list, and then they're going to have their teaching job, and they're going to have their novel periodically, and that's they're going to be their income. And the children's writers that I know do work for hire. They tend to sort of do more small stuff.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm wrong, but that's been my experience.
Well, because Any Which Wall was done in this rather extraordinary crank-it-out conditions, which I'm not even sure if that's a valid sentence, but we'll let it stand, this book shares much in common with Edward Eger's books, that began with Half Magic. You have 4 children. You have casual magic presented over the course of a dull summer. But I'm wondering if there's a risk... possibly in being too tied to influence or too
tied
to homage, that if you are given certain circumstances that maybe you, Laurel, perhaps go explicitly to, like, oh yes, well, we got to go ahead and get Edward Eger. That this was sort of almost a crutch, or
I'll be completely honest. There is some element of that. Like, the sort of my agent said to me, I said, I need a certain amount of money by a certain date. And my agent said to me, you know, is there any way that could happen? I mean, it's not like I was pitching this book. I called her and was sort of like, I've never had an agent before. How do agents help people find money? I mean, I, like, really didn't know what I was doing. she said, what would you want to do next? And this was something that had been in the back of my mind to do. Certainly there was some sense that having the structure or the sort of guidance of it being a sort of tribute novel would in some ways make it a little easier, because I'm new to all of this. I mean, I'm a novice, and I'm just learning how to go. That said, I wrote the book. It wasn't that easy. I rewrote the book. We had to rip off the second half of the book. I rewrote the 100 pages in 2 months or something. It's not... I wouldn't advocate that anybody should write that way, but it certainly helped me that there was the eager stuff. But at the end of the day, it didn't actually make it as simple as one might imagine. I do think my next book, I'm taking longer to work on, and it is less of that kind of a book. It is a much more personal. I'm approaching it in a different way, and so I don't know. There's a part of me that attaches value or lack of value to the idea of kind of cranking something out.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly hoping on this next one to sort of have a more leisurely approach. But there is something to be said for sitting your ass in a chair, I guess is what I'm saying.
Maybe I'm wondering if it was a matter of your agent essentially presenting the Roger Corman movie poster and then you making the movie with the Edward Eger.
No. I mean, really, it was my proposal. These were my pages. I wrote the beginning of the book, and it still stands in much the same format. It was a book that I had in the back of my mind to do. It was definitely was generated by me.
You wrote an essay about sexism in YA, and yet I couldn't help but notice that when the children first approached the wall, they addressed the wall as a he.
That's
upholding the patriarchy, I have to say, and I must object to this.
Yeah.
Why not a she? Why even a he or a she? Why not a it? Why the he? I'm just curious.
I think we're all the product of our culture, and I think that the point of my sexism in children's writing essay was that this is within me. That it was my editor who said to me, how come the families in your books are all nuclear? How come the families in your books, the mother takes the name of the father? How come in these families, the fathers work and the mothers stay home? And it was problematic for me. And what I was me recognizing in myself as a writer with these ideas, that I had these impulses. So, I mean, to be perfectly honest, the reason the wall is a man, if that is a sexist thing, is because inside me somewhere is still that vestigial sense of patriarchy. Yeah. And I haven't exercised it fully. I'm very aware of it in the new book. There are some gender flip. I mean, there's some stuff that happens in the book that will be out next year, which is called Penny Dreadful, where there are some role reversals and some other models. But it's definitely something that I'm approaching very consciously. And I think that's because I write to these sort of mid-century, old-fashioned children's books in which mothers stay home and fathers work and little girls wear dresses and little boys wear shorts and carry slingshots. You know, that is the world I write out of.
Yeah.
And two, the fact that my own political ideas or sense of myself in the world is not in concert with that is confusing to me too, and I on a daily basis as I work sort of try and revise some of that stuff out of my work. But I also think that my job is to in some ways depict what the world is, and I do think the world is still a patriarchy. The question is then how do the children question that or react to that or think about that, and that's
But
that's
since they're still forming their own impressions about this, it's not entirely fair to go ahead and blame them for saying he, because that's what they're being taught all along, I suppose.
I'm just saying, they are partly manifestations of my prejudices, but it is also true that as an author, you have the opportunity to manipulate how, you know, so they approach the wall, they say he, and then how do you define that he? What does that he end up becoming to them? Or do they question the he-ness of the wall? I mean, it didn't even occur to me until this very minute, so I don't know. Maybe the wall is...
Sorry to guilt you into this, yeah.
No, maybe the wall's a cross-dresser. I don't know. I haven't thought about it. Yeah. I did think about the wall as referential to the Western Wall in Jerusalem, and I definitely have a patriarchal sense of what that is. I mean, for me, religion is a patriarchal... I think in the little girl part of my brain, I still think about God as an old man in a white robe. There's still that, despite being Jewish, and I know I'm not supposed to have that kind of an idea, but God is still male in my head. Yeah. So if the wall is the wall, and God is in that wall somewhere, which isn't explicitly how I approached it, but... It is patriarchal.
We need more people painting over the churches with Alanis Morissette or something.
Right.
The wall, it's interesting because here you were facing your own particular wall with the financial obstacles, and I'm wondering if that's what led to the wall actually emerging in the course of the story here.
The wall, the money wall.
Yeah, exactly. We're all facing it.
There's
right?
actually in the new book, there's all these references to the money river, the family's out of cash. This may be of interest.
Yeah.
The family's out of cash, and the little girl sort of decides to try and fix the family's financial situation by sort of finding a magical solution to their...
Got it.
Their situation.
I was also curious about the italicized passages too in the course of the book, and yet I happened to notice that there weren't any italics through the remainder of the book, that you actually capitalized words like no or over, what did I, full of wildflowers and the like. And you often did it where you did a series of three words, and the last one was actually capitalized, and so I'm curious about the aversion to italics. You feel that the only way you could use italics were if you, Laurel Snyder, the author, would be to step
this
in.
This is a fight. This is an argument between sort of editors and writers in general, not just me. Yeah. This is something writers, there's been a Twitter conversation about this lately of like the abuse of M dashes and italics and how much we all love them and how ultimately our editors want to take away our italics.
Bastards.
I do use italics in general, and often they come out, if not in the editorial phase, then in the copy editing phase. There are sort of layers upon layers of fact-checking and copy editing that sort of filter out some of that stuff. So the book probably started with a lot more than it has now. And sometimes when I italicize a whole section, what's interesting is there's this dilemma where, like, I want to italicize a single word. Like the sentence might be like, that's my coffee cup, and it'd be like, that's my italicized, that's my coffee cup. And then you italicize that whole section, and I lose that my, and it's like, well, can I double italicize? You know, what would I do to, like, indicate that this was doubly italicized?
Italicize and underline, presumably, but then it becomes redundant.
Yeah, that's ugly. I mean, can't underline.
What describe these battles? I'm kind of curious. I mean, were there lengthy telephone conversations look, I need the italics here.
Right. Like, I get back the galley copies, and then sort of my editor will have written in Roman next to the place where she wants to lose the italics, and sometimes I fight her, and sometimes it's a good filter level for me because I do tend to italicize too much. So sort of, if you italicize every word, it doesn't mean anything.
How much did you fight with your editor? I mean, how many of the changes?
Oh, it's not fighting. It's tussling.
How much did you dispute in a civil manner?
I think it all depends on the editor that you have, right? Like, I trust my editor pretty completely. If she's telling me something, I may not take exactly her suggestion, but if she's pointing to a place where she thinks there's an issue, I'm inclined to think that there's probably actually an issue. So what I will do is sort of that will draw my attention to the question of like, well, what does need to happen there differently than is happening right now? It's very rare that I'll fight anything major just because we really do see eye to eye and I really do trust her taste.
Mm-hmm.
And you get, you know, it's like you get so deep inside a manuscript that you're lost in a labyrinth. Like you can't see it any longer. And then having somebody else come in with fresh eyes and point these things out. So I think the trick is to listen to your instincts, that you can't listen to everything somebody else tells you, but you also can't become resistant to direction.
Sure.
And I feel like you just have to, like, listen to your gut, and if it resonates what they're saying, if what they're saying really upsets you, they're probably right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, I think that if she says, this chapter is problematic, and my response to that is, no, it's not, then probably there's a problem. Because if I actually had a more sort of calm response to it, then maybe there'd be an argument there.
I could see your point, and you're right on this.
Right. But maybe but if I'm like, no, then it probably means that she's right, and I'm defensive.
Yeah, got it. Well, I mean, how defensive are you? I mean,
I'm a defensive human being. I mean, we're all defensive.
We're all defensive to some degree. But, I mean, with writing, that's a very personal labor, so it makes me ask about, I don't know. It seems to me that you probably do get along with your editor, but... This is very odd. In fact, I've never really asked this question of writers about how defensive they are in relation to their writing when they're talking with their editor. I mean, you're not David Foster Wallace popping out some three-page memo in relation to, like, one sentence or anything like that.
Right. My editor's... I really think it depends on how well the editor listens, too. Like, when I've resisted her, she's never fought me back. Like, if anything where I feel strongly enough to say no... she'll take a step backward. Because at the end of the day, it is my book. So, I don't know. Like, I guess that hasn't... I have fights with many people in this world, but not my editor.
Yeah.
I'm very, very lucky that way.
I had a question about a particular word that pops up. Tish and Susan create, allegedly create, the word Blekish, that you claim as narrator that Blekish is part of their secret language, but when I searched around on Google Book Search, discovered that Blekish could be found in the 1894 edition of Transactions of the American Entomological Society, numerous turn-of-the-century documents pertaining to flora and fish. So
just because you created something doesn't mean somebody else didn't create it too.
Well, that's the great moral dilemma of this particular word, and I'm curious, what is your own personal relationship to the word Blekish here?
There are other books where authors have created secret languages. In specific, a book called The Secret Language.
Yeah.
And I wanted to recall that for Tish and Susan. I don't have any particular attachment to the word Blekish, but I think it's possible that they invented it at the same time that somebody else was inventing it at some other point in history. I didn't steal it.
Rats danced in the deep, dark ravine that ran beside them. Dancing rats? I haven't seen rats dance. I've seen them scurry away. I was curious about that.
Poetic license.
I wondered if there was a sort of festivity to the urban pestilence that runs through New York.
That's not true. Definitely. I mean, I made a very brief attempt to move to the city of New York, and I was very lonely, and I missed my boyfriend who was back in Iowa, and I made it like 5 months, and then I like ran back to Iowa. But I loved the subway, and it was like summer, and it would be hot and gross, and the rats would be crawling around. But I would sort of sit there and watch them in my weird, depressed summer state. So I definitely, there is a sort of festivity to the rats, or the idea that like there's this whole other world down there going on beside and around us.
Absolutely. Have you read Robert Sullivan's Rats, that book? It's all about rats in New York, how anywhere in New York, you're always within, I think, 20 feet of a rat.
Sure.
Yeah, it's really, really creepy.
I actually kept rats as a child.
Oh, really? Ah, okay. So I can understand why you didn't
dance.
I kept
rats until my stepmother's dog ate them.
Yeah.
Which was disturbing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You have an old lady on a unicycle in a subway station.
Yeah.
And I was curious about that because I've never seen anything like that. And, of course, particularly during rush hour, there's not a lot of space in the subway station to actually run around in a circle on a unicycle.
Maybe you're not paying attention.
I do pay attention, believe me.
One of the most magical New York memories that I've ever had was of being on the train by myself, a little bit tipsy, late at night one night, and a magician came through the car and he had a pot, like a steel pot, and he opened the lid, and a bird flew out. It was like a dove in a pot. So maybe, I mean, I think I invented the unicycle, but it is in the spirit of. Maybe she brought the unicycle down. That's not true. I could totally see it over there, where's the connecting path.
Well, the thing is that most subway stations, though, in New York, you don't specify the subway station, although the train does go to Coney Island,
and all the
stations along that line have a very thin isthmus. So that's why
Are you suggesting that I didn't do complete research
for my middle grade magic novel? I'm curious about where the I mean, I could buy a magician with the bird flying out, but that's because he's not on a unicycle. You have this square area that you have to ride around, and you're going to run into people like that.
They do that thing where they go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, but you have it going in a circle, though. I'm totally splitting hairs here.
All right.
Henry opines that all meals should be hand-holdable and that forks and spoons should be against the law. You, again, as the narrator, and this is what's interesting, is that you as the narrator
frequently,
a little intrusive, and you start to question what your characters are saying. And you object to this line of reasoning, writing, how could you ever eat spaghetti without a fork, and how could you live without spaghetti? I must object to your objection.
You could live without spaghetti?
No. You can still eat spaghetti without a fork. You can always slurp up the noodles. Now, it's going to make a big deal of a mess, and particularly...
You don't have a two-year-old, do you?
No, I don't.
I have a two-year-old and have seen people eat spaghetti without a fork, and may I say, it's not pleasant.
But Henry may very well just want to slurp his spaghetti. What's so wrong about that? He's going through a sort of slurping stage as opposed to the more civilized fork.
I think that Henry's mother would object. Now, this is the intrusive narrator thing is an interesting thing. It's coming out in the next book. The first two books both have this, Scratchy Mountains and Any Which Wall, both have this intrusive narrator. And it's a voice that I take from earlier books, and I really like those kinds of books myself. But I've begun to realize that there's a degree to which if you assert that much as a narrator, sort of the characters never fully detach from me. And so the next book, I've let that go. And in the book that I'm starting on right now, the book that I'm not going to have a deadline for, the book that I'm going to try and do differently, I'm actually going to first person. And it's, I mean, it's scary to me, but I sort of, I'm letting go of my, letting go of not only my intrusive narrator, but the third person altogether.
But I don't know if I agree with the idea of a nagging narrator getting in the way of characters. If anything, it actually causes certain...
But it creates a kind of meta. I mean, like, it creates a kind of frame for the book that as long as the narrator is there... This is something I think about a lot, actually. Like, in a lot of children's books, the kid is telling the story. Like, it's a first-person story, but it's not a diary. And, I mean, this happens in adult books, too. It's the sort of the opening of, like, this happened last October kind of voice.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, who the hell are you talking to? Like the sort of, who is that person talking to? When sort of the narrator is stepping forward and saying, you know, you, the reader, blah, 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 it creates a kind of stage, right?
Yeah.
It creates a kind of stage for those characters to be performing on. And I think on some level, there's a sort of theatrical, sort of, like, it's a voiceover. And it's like, you know how when you're watching a movie and there's a voiceover or, like, music starts in the background and, like, kids will joke, they'll be like, where's that music coming from?
Yeah.
It's that moment of, like, where's that voice coming from? I actually have an idea for an adult novel that I'll probably never write where the book begins with a third person, like, omniscient narrator. And then in, like, a page 150, that same voice says, you.
Yeah.
Or me. And you realize that it's the voice of God. That, like, that third person voice is essentially the voice of God.
Yeah.
Like, letting that God then enter for the second half of the book to be a character.
Sure.
Would be I can't imagine actually writing that book, but I like the idea of it existing. The point is that, like, as long as the me, Laurel Snyder, me the narrator, is intruding that way, I feel like I'm never fully giving the characters control of the story.
But I don't necessarily see it that way. I mean, I could see where you are probably drawing that conclusion from particularly
this
the second...
This is just for me.
Oh, yeah,
just
I know. From the second italicized section where you're saying, well, most writers don't actually write about this thing. But on the other hand, Don Quixote is all about a nagging narrator who is ridiculing this guy for tilting at windmills. And yet we still sympathize with...
It's not an issue of sympathizing. It's an issue of how human Don Quixote can become.
Yeah.
And Don Quixote never fully becomes human, right? Like, he's a caricature. That's the whole point about Don Quixote.
Yeah, he's a caricature, but since it's being filtered through this prism, we come to sympathize with him.
I don't know. I've never really thought this through, so I can't claim this entirely. But on some level, I feel like, and this is not a value judgment. Some of my very favorite books have that intrusive narrator in them. The point is that for me as a writer, I mean, I think most writers want to grow with each book, want to change with each book. I don't know where I'm headed, but I know that at this moment in time, it feels like that kind of control that I've been exerting over the sort of themes of the book or the, like, psychology of the book or essentially, it's instructive. It's trying to tell the reader what to think and how to feel. If the narrator isn't doing that work, then a character has to do that work. Something else or imagery has to do that work. Something else has to do that work, sort of has to direct traffic. And right now it feels like I have been so excessively directing traffic that I have not explored what the characters themselves can do.
But that rests on the assumption that the reader actually goes along with the narrator. I have just objected to the spaghetti, for
That's
example,
right.
And I went with Henry.
Well, this isn't to say
book.
That it's not profitable, right? The point is just that for the next book, I want to try something different.
Okay.
It's not that this isn't useful or good or that people shouldn't. It's just that, and in fact, like, sort of, one of the big criticisms that Scratchy Mountains got when I first sent it out, because I send out, with children's books, you can actually send your own books to editors without going through an agent. So the first book actually was pulled from the slush. And that was one of the things, for the 50 people who rejected it before it was pulled from slush, that was one of the things they really objected to, was that, like, over-assertive, intrusive narrator. And the market changed in the intervening years when I was sending this book out. Kate DiCamillo started doing that. And, I mean, there's sort of the Lemony Snicket. There is this sense of, like, instructing sort of in an old-fashioned way. So it became something that wasn't unmarketable, and the book sold, and the next book sold. But I'm just at a place where creatively I'm scared of the first person. But I'm even just scared of taking out my own voice. And
why are you scared of the first person?
Because my strength so far has not been in... I'm somebody who relies on a lot of sort of funny wordplay and things like that, that dance. A book that's really stripped down, I mean, I feel like that doesn't work in first person. In first person, you really have to believe in that one character.
Yeah.
If you don't buy that this is a real human being telling you this story, even if it's funny, even if it's quirky, even if it's odd, if you don't buy that person who's telling the story is a real person, the book falls apart. right? I can't think of a book that's told in first person where I don't believe in that first character. Yeah. And so I feel like for me, it's letting go of my caricatures. And in fact, this was the big struggle with the book that's coming out next year. We wrote it four times. I rewrote this book four times, and it changed so dramatically from the first stretch. The first draft did have the intrusive narrative. The second draft, I took that out, but like sort of changes happened all along. And it was my editor at one point called me and said, "You have a choice." I'd written, I mean, they were, the family were like the Dreadfuls, and he worked at Dreadful Industries, and she like, you know, carried around a book of cold soup recipe. I mean, it was this odd sort of, she ran around, the mother ran around the house in gold lamé dresses. It was a very funny caricature, Mrs. Pigglewiggle kind of middle grade book. And my editor essentially, but the storyline was about the family losing their fortune, moving to a new place, and the little girl trying to become friends with other kids and not knowing how to do that. And basically my editor called me and said, "You have a choice to make. You can either write the story in which this little girl goes through this emotional process, or you can write the book in which people run around the house in gold lamé dresses, and you know, they sort of like these humorous caricature elements are going to undercut on some level." But now, this is not always true. Roald Dahl did it, right? James and the Giant Peach, you buy that James is a sad, lonely little boy, despite the fact that Aunt Spiker and Aunt whatever their names, I don't remember, on Sponge and on Spiker are ridiculous caricatures. But I'm not Roald Dahl. I'm not, and maybe someday I'll be that kind of a...
But you are Laurel Snyder.
I am Laurel Snyder, but I did not feel like I was up to that. I couldn't even imagine how one would do that. I went back and reread my doll, but I couldn't figure out how to do that. And so I sort of had a choice to make of moving back toward the caricature or sort of letting go of that technique and that device, which does feel sort of like a crutch at this point in my writing path, and trying to write something that was about a real little girl who was actually lonely. And the question was sort of, you can try and make them laugh or you can try and make them cry, kind of which direction you're going to go with. Ideally, you do a little bit of both, but and I pushed that direction and it took four drafts. Like, it was really hard, and at one point I actually called my agent and my editor and said I might want to pull the book. Like, I was scared at an earlier phase of drafts that I hadn't succeeded and I hadn't pulled that off. But for me, I feel everybody has their journey, right? Somebody somewhere out there listening is starting at the other end of the spectrum. They know how to write a touching moment, but they don't know how to write humor.
Yeah.
For me, humor is the part that is, and wordplay and sort of silly scenario and imagination, like that's the part that's, I don't want to say it's easy, but it's my comfort zone. Yeah. And trying to write a book, I've been rereading Cynthia Voigt's, I don't know if as a kid you read the Tellerman trilogy, but
I missed that.
There's a book called Dicey Song that, like, it makes me weep. And I can't imagine writing a book that would make you weep. Like, I can't imagine being the person that wrote a book that makes someone weep. And that, to me, like, that's the goal.
Yeah.
It's like, somewhere along, who knows what my trajectory will look like, but, like, I'm sort of, I feel like I have to figure out how to let go of some of these other things and learn how to really get to know one character well and be able to, like, speak in their voice to sort of make that transition. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think I want to ask you, going back to what you were talking about earlier, this notion of believability in first person versus third person. You say that you were reluctant to approach first person because you didn't think you could believe in that particular voice. Well, why is third person easier for you to believe in your characters? This notion of belief, and tied into reader response and reader reaction and pleasing an audience, which it seems to me that that's also a factor here too.
For sure. I don't know. I mean, I'm a storyteller. I like the framework of storytelling. I have a lot of my adult poems start with the words "once upon a time." Like, I'm into that framework as an idea. I'm into the idea of mythology. I sort of believe that there are these tricks and devices that seem simplistic at first, and sort of may or may not, but can be used in deeper ways. That can be signifiers for something more important or complicated. But sort of everybody has, this isn't a, you know, again, this isn't a value thing. This isn't about what people should be writing. This is simply about where I'm moving and how I'm trying to get there.
Yeah.
And for me, stripping away some of these tricks, and they weren't tricks when I first did them. But the point is, it becomes, anything you do over and over becomes a trick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, I'm trying to think of a good example of somebody whose work I really, really admire, but they do the same thing over and over again. And by the time you write that sixth book that uses that same device, you're no longer inventing anything. You're no longer...
Oh, well, I think you're selling yourself. I think any writer who says something like that is selling himself short, because there's an inevitable pattern of repetition that's subconscious that you just don't know about.
Absolutely, but you're but each time you're trying to transform it. And I had hit a place where it felt like I needed to do a departure, to sort of learn the next, and it's, I mean, honestly, like, this is a strange conversation to be having right now because I just turned this book in. Like, it's in copy editing and I'm scared to death that it fails, that I let go of the piece that was easiest for me to do well, and in hopes of sort of producing something bigger and more interesting. And it's not even bigger. It's still a, like, lower middle grade sort of small children's, but, like, it's not, this isn't about, like, grandiose projects or the great American novel. This is just about my own personal development as a writer. Like, I want to write something. I want to write something that makes, that touches a kid.
Yeah.
And I, it's not to say that nothing I've written does, but, like, I want to write something that touches them more.
Yeah.
And I don't know what I want to do next. Maybe the next thing will be exactly the opposite. Maybe I'll decide to do a comic book. Like, who sort of, who knows what the path will be. But right now, at this moment in time, it feels like this is something I've already been doing. And with a fairly effectively, it's time for me to try and let go of the thing I do effectively in order to do something that's a little riskier.
I wonder if actually,
and the next book's going to be even more so. The next book's crazy. The next book's like magic, but it's all about divorce.
Well, I mean, I wonder if really it's really about letting go of this effect upon an audience of touching a kid. I mean, you can't always control. I mean, for stuff I write, I'll labor on like something for like an hour or two, and everybody loves it. And
then writers
stuff,
are control
and then,
freaks.
And then the stuff that like takes like 10 hours and just involves serious, like put my heart and soul into, people just, oh yeah, okay, I like the funny stuff.
That's,
I mean,
right.
To a certain degree, you can't control how you're going to be perceived, you know.
Writers are control freaks.
Yeah.
And we do, like, we want, you know what, that's it. That is it. That is it. If I can tell the reader how to read this, if I can tell them, if I say, and I mean, I think we all do this, like, at a party or wherever we are. It's like you get uncomfortable, you tell a joke, that kind of thing. It's like, because if you tell a joke that you know is funny and has often elicited a bit of laughter, then you know in that situation, it is likely that the laughter will come at that moment too, right? It's sort of like if it's like somebody feeling like no one's paying attention to them, so they take their shirt off, right? If you take your shirt off, people will probably pay attention to you, especially if you happen to be a woman. But, you know, like if you do something crazy at a party, people will pay attention to you. Like, children act out in that way. I think there is an element of control here. It's like if you're in the middle of the woods in your book, you're in the weeds, and you sort of don't know what to do, you go to the thing that you know most effectively will control the audience's response.
Yeah. But maybe it's not a matter of going to your innate voice. It's a matter of, I mean, it seems to me that we're dealing with a really elaborate scenario where...
Yeah, no, this is interesting.
I mean, on one hand, you want to please an audience. On another hand, you like your voice, the humor and wordplay, but on the, you want to expand that voice.
Right.
Then there's this additional aspect of trying to defy your innate voice as well, you know, defying your own particular expectations.
Well, this is the challenge every writer faces for their entire lives, right? I mean, this is my first poetry workshop, the first class I ever took. It becomes very quickly apparent that what you're trying to do is find a voice and continue growing, right? Like, each poem should be better than the last poem or different than the last poem. Each book should be better than the last book, and yet you want something that is authentically yours. You want something that feels distinct, that feels individual to you.
Yeah.
I think, and maybe this is specific to me because my first two books feel, I don't want to say derivative, it's not that, it's imitative. I mean, I'm an imitative writer. I'm somebody who really does sit down. The first book definitely had a connection to the 13 clocks. The second book definitely had a connection to Half Magic. They are books, they're sort of, I began as a children's writer in part because I believe so firmly that these were wonderful books that I grew up with, and I wanted to be a part of that conversation.
Yeah.
That is in some ways in conflict with the idea of creating something of your own and finding that balance, like melting those things together. Like, I want to create my own voice. I want there to be a voice that sounds like me. At the same time, I don't want to do it over and over and over again the same way. I want to do it differently each time. And so, and I think the point is, you never actually let go of your voice. If I write a book in first person, that first person is going to sound remarkably like the intrusive narrator in my other books, because I'm me. I can't get away from my voice.
Yeah.
I'm just going to try and do it differently.
On the other hand, I might also argue that perhaps you are judging yourself, as we all do, far too much than how other people are perceiving you, in the sense that...
Yeah, but I don't care about other people. I mean, like
yeah,
that's
but you
my
do
job.
Care, but you do care about yourself, perhaps inordinately, in that is incommensurate with how the readers receive your work, and also incommensurate with how you're evolving without
I don't you think actually anyone will it. Ever, well, I don't know, I can't speak for other people. I will never, ever be satisfied with a book that I've written. And I don't ever want to be the kind of writer who is satisfied with the books that I've written. Like, I feel like learning things is dependent upon a willingness to be self-critical.
Yeah.
And this is not to say that I don't like my books. I do. I think they're great. Like, I mean, I don't say that in any... I wouldn't have given them... I don't mean to be conceited. Like, they're great books because they wouldn't be out there if I didn't... If I didn't feel confident that they were worth reading, I wouldn't have handed them over to my editor, right? Like, I would have pulled them and given the money back. Like, I wouldn't publish a book that I thought was crap. That said, they're all completely inadequate. And they always will be. Like, everything I write is... I don't know, like, how... Like, I was, like, 16 when somebody said to me, it's always about the next thing.
Yeah.
It's never about the thing you're finishing. It's always about the next thing you're about to start. It's just the lessons you're learning. So, for me, I don't know. For me, it really is. It's always about the next book.
Are you a writer who prefers to have written or enjoys writing? Which was the greater pleasure for you, would you say?
I actually enjoy writing. I find it very hard to sit down. I'm an impatient, sort of fidgety person, and I find it hard to kind of settle into that first page or that first hour, but the feeling of being in that groove of writing and the sort of invention that goes along with that, I love. The other piece that I love, which I think is part of the writing process, is the sort of, there's so little silence in the world now, between Twitter feeds and traffic and radio and everywhere you look, there's stimulus. I love the feeling of having the radio off and my kids asleep in the car. I do a lot of driving. I've put 30,000 miles on my car in the last year and a half with my kids in it.
Yeah.
And I love the feeling of being on Interstate 81, driving through Virginia with the kids asleep in the back of the car, no radio on, staring out the window. And it's like there's that moment of silence where you can actually think for a minute.
Yeah.
And for me, actually, I think that's the most important part right now of the writing process, because my life, because of the kids, has so little silence in it that, like... Like, I carry a dictaphone in the car, and I love that feeling of, like, working out the outline or doing, like, I mean, I'll sort of in out loud, I'll over and over repeatedly say something until I feel like I've got it right, and then I'll record it.
Yeah.
Where I'm sort of writing in my head. Yeah. Much of it doesn't get used, but just that feeling of sort of working through language and trying to get to something, I don't know, reduced or refined, is... like the happiest thing in the world for me. So I'm a writer who actually likes writing. I also like having written. I love the feeling of, I don't shower in the morning. I love the feeling of writing and then taking a shower and kind of showering off the writing day.
I can relate to that,
grabbing a beer. Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. So you shower off the sweaty day and grab a beer. It's the best feeling in the world. But no, I like writing. And I do think that having children has been very useful to me. I don't think I could be doing the kind of schedule that I'm doing now if I didn't have kids. Like, every second that I'm not working with children...
You're writing.
I have to write, yeah. And when I was a hard-drinking waitress, it was a lot harder to sit down.
This is interesting because I'm wondering... You're often dealing with a random moment, the next random moment where, like, okay, the kids are asleep. I can go ahead and focus in on this particular project I'm working
on.
Right, right. But what's interesting about this is that you... It's actually... an uncalculated form of discipline, subject to the whims
that's
of the universe.
Right. And so right, that's right.
I'm
and
sure this is probably
And what I write has a lot to do with what happens to be going on in that moment of time when suddenly I have a minute.
But do you feel that you get enough moments even in this randomness, or is it just constant frustration?
Oh, that, no, like, it's constantly frustrating. And I dream. I mean, I love being home with my kids, but I dream about kindergarten and sort of what will it be like when they go off to school in the morning and don't come home until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't even imagine what that freedom will feel like at this point.
J. Robert Lennon told me that he wrote pieces of The Left Hand while his kids were napping, and that he'd work on a little section of it. I'm not sure if something along those lines works for you.
Absolutely, no. Yeah. I mean, I've got all these. I've got like notebooks by the bed, and like tape recorders in the car, and I mean, I've got all these weird documents on my. If you were to look at my desktop on my computer, I have like all of these documents called like. I don't know what this is, or like weird story about the color blue, where it's like I got half a sentence written and then like I'll come back to it someday. And so I'm in this place right now where I feel like I have like a gajillion false starts. I have like 3 novels lined up that I want to write. I have like 30 picture books that I haven't revived. I have a manuscript of poems. Like I've just sort of, I generate all this stuff. And what I don't have is the focus to sit down and finish things. Or, I mean, sort of unless I'm essentially on deadline for something, nothing gets finished. But a lot gets started. And what I'm hoping is that there will come a day that I'll be able to sit down and revisit all of these things.
With these random moments and a deadline, how then do you turn something out? I mean, is this where your husband comes in?
When I was turning Any Which Wall, and when the last draft of Any Which Wall was going in, there were like 2 nights in a row where I was just up until like 5 in the morning, and he would like walk in the door, and I would like throw a pot of macaroni and cheese at his head and like disappear into my bedroom.
Wow.
And then he'd take the kids to bed, and I'd creep back downstairs to the office. That like. There is a lot of that kind of, but my husband's a musician and he has a similar kind of, like he has a day job and a music thing and, yeah. You know, sort of, our household, there's a lot of moving pieces. But we're both people who thrive on insanity, I guess.
Ugh. Well, craziness is great, but do you worry about possibly overextending yourself
totally.
With all these ideas here and how do you
manage
that?
No, what I worry about is not being present in my life.
Yeah.
I worry about a couple of things. I worry about not being present in my life because I'm always thinking about work. That I don't have clear boundaries between those two worlds, and that bothers me. I worry about the internet. I worry that as obsessively online as I am, and I'm very into the sort of web community stuff, I worry that that is pulling me away from the kind of focus as a writer that I want. What I think of as my poet brain, that like all the tweets are taking up all the lines of poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, I do worry. It's confusing to me because I do write poems for grown-ups and children's books and the occasional essay, and I do some radio work for All Things Considered. And I feel like I just did an interesting event yesterday at the Pratt Institute where we talked about sort of the lines between genres. And I was trying, I actually for the first time ever did a reading where I read poems and then I added in some picture book manuscripts without telling them where they were. So I was just reading them as though the picture book manuscripts were poetry. And it was really interesting for me because it is true that like I approach it all as language, and then it's a question of like, well, is this sentence or this idea or this line something that belongs in a poem? Is it something that belongs? I mean, sort of on some level, it's just language play, and then I find a form. But I do worry professionally that I sometimes feel like a dilettante. Like I don't know where my focus is, and I feel like as time goes by, I may have to. Tighten up my focus a little bit.
But you've got books, so it seems pretty clear that you're an author to me.
I'm an author. I'm publishing them. But we pick our battles in life,
yeah.
You know? Like, when we choose our projects, and when I'm working on a novel, I'm probably not focused on poetry, and when I'm, you know... I mean, it's just different, and it is nice that when I turn in a novel, I don't immediately start something else. Then I kind of go back and revisit some of the old picture book manuscripts, or I work on some poems, or whatever. They occupy very different parts of my brain.
Yeah.
But that's a little confusing. I mean, it can be a little schizophrenic.
But if you can't do everything, I mean, how do you go about... I mean, you're going to have to quell this impulse at some point, you know, and just accept the fact...
No, I can just loathe myself for the rest of my life. Obviously, that's the solution. No, writing is the most fun thing in the world for me, except, like, hanging with my kids. Like, that's sort of... I'm very, very, very lucky in that the two things I like best to do are the two things that it is right now in my life, my job to do. It is sometimes a little hard... to balance those two sets of things, but I enjoy it all, and that makes it okay that it makes me insane, I guess.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good exit point, but Laurel, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank
it was a
you
pleasure.
So much. It's nice to be here.
All right.
If the world was oblong shaped, then you would make it square. Just to let the whole world know that you were standing there. And if I had a chance or way to tell you how I feel, you would make the four walls cry to let me know you're